We're going to finish the chapter. There's just two verses left to finish chapter 6. Purusha Sukta confirmed. And the previous verse, was Sutta Goswami confirming or summarizing Karna Dakshay Vishnu, Garbha Dakshay Vishnu, and their role in the process of creation. And that had been detailed in the chapter. He made his concluding summary remarks and then is now closing the chapter. So the texts 43, 45, they're combined together. He's already answered this, but now he's answering it again. Narada, what launched this whole description was Narada asking a number of questions, the foremost of which was, Brahma, are you the Supreme? You're the creator of the whole thing. Is there somebody beyond you? Are you deriving your energies from yourself or from some other source? And so forth. Are you the Absolute Truth? And in this verse, this collection, 43 through 45, the answer is no. Not only I'm not, it gives a whole long inventory list of others who are not, but rather you're just a fragment of the unlimited potencies of the Supreme. So read the translation. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
This is Brahma speaking to Narada, so it's the first, it's first person singular, aham. Then Lord Shiva, also Lord Vishnu is included. Great generators of living beings like Daksha and Prajapati, yourselves, that's sages like Narada and the Kumaras, heavenly demigods like Indra and Chandra, the leaders of poor loka planets, the leaders of bhuloka planets, the earthly planets, plural, the leaders of the lower planets, the leaders of the Gandharva planets, Vidyadhara planets, Charanaloka planets, Yakshas, Rakshasas, Urugas, the great sages, the great demons, the great atheists, the great spacemen, as well as the dead bodies, evil spirits, Satans, Jinn, Kusamandas, great aquatics, great beasts, great birds, etc. In other words, anything and everything which is exceptionally possessed of power, opulence, mental and perceptual dexterity, strength, forgiveness, beauty, modesty, opulence, and breeding, whether in form or formless, etc. They all may appear to be the specific truth and the form of the Lord, but actually they are not so. They are only a fragment of the transcendental potency of the Lord. So the main message is obvious. the absolute truth is that from which everything emanates. So in one sense, this is then a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Vedanta is exploring that from which everything else emanates, or the absolute truth, Tato Brahma Jigyasa. And Janmadhyasa Yataha, just as the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam begins like that. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Janmadhyasa Yatonvaya Itaratas Chartesho Pavikya Swarat. The previous chapter is the cause of all causes. So this verse is saying even Vishnu, please note, even Vishnu's in this list. So he's certainly the cause of the cosmic manifestation. But then Vishnu is an expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna. He's the cause of all causes. And the Purusha Sukta mantras from Rig Veda also present the same conclusion. So this is confirming Purusha Sukta. From the spiritual world, beyond this cosmic manifestation, the Supreme Lord expands himself as the Purusha avatars, who then one by one expand themselves. Anyway, so the process of creation goes like that. And same understanding is there in Brahma Samhita. Hari Vilas was indicating last night the Brahma Samhita is the who's who of the spiritual world. But it's not exactly just a who's who of the spiritual world, because there are a lot of verses where who's who amongst the demigods are identified, and then how the demigods are deriving their glories are presented, and then they're deriving their strength from Govinda. So it's more the relation of all entities that are powerful, how they connect with the source of their power. Srishti, Stiti, Pralaya, Sadhana Shaktireka, Chayeva Yasya Bhuvanani Vimarti, Durga. So Durga is responsible for Srishti, Stiti, and Pralaya, which is interesting because that's all three phases of creation. Normally we say Brahma's in charge of creation, and Vishnu's in charge of maintenance, and Rudra's in charge of, or Lord Shiva's in charge of destruction. So, how does that work? Brahma's creation is, how it works is this way. There's different components of creation, or there's different causes, different causal factors of creation. Just like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in Adi Lila, there's a description of the principally remote cause, the ingredient cause. There's different Upadan Maya and Pradhan Maya. Those are two features of the energy portion of creation. And then there's the remote cause. So like that's Vishnu. Anyways, it gets very technical without going into the technicalities of it. That's found in relation to Advaita Acharya, where he, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, wants to show how Advaita Acharya is not different than Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu is specific amongst the causal factors. He's the ingredient cause. And then there's the ingredients, and the ingredients themselves are causes. Just as the verse in Bhagavad Gita is there, where the kartritvam, we covered this verse yesterday, karmani lokasya srijate prabho. One should not think of oneself as the cause of action, nor should one consider oneself to be the cause of the results of action, nor should one consider that one can cause others to act. Rather, all this is being carried out by Prakriti. So Prakriti has that causal function. But Prakriti doesn't move without Purusha. So then the Purusha, or the controller of Durga, is Lord Shiva. But then Lord Shiva is under, as a servant of Lord Vishnu, is under the direction of Lord Vishnu, who then chooses for Durga to move in certain ways. So she does this through her potencies. One can describe through her potencies she's doing, but there's also the potent. Without the will of the Supreme Lord, Durga doesn't create. Durga doesn't destroy. Durga doesn't do anything. Durga's in the unmanifest pradhan state. So, in short, without the technicalities, there are different ways of describing the same thing from different perspectives, different features or components of creation. And Prabhupada gets into that not in technical detail, but he gets into it in the purport by saying that these the different ways. The modern scientist is also captivated by the wonderful actions and reactions of natural phenomena, and therefore is also a shakta, going above. Those who are simply astonished by the powers of anything in the creation of the Lord, without any factual information of the Lord himself, are known as shaktas, or worshippers of great powers. The modern scientist is also captivated by the wonderful actions and reactions of natural phenomena, and therefore is also a shakta. Pretty interesting. Modern scientists are shaktas. I guess they don't know it, but at least the principle is they're not acknowledging the source of the power, but their view is that all that exists is material nature and the laws of nature, and everything comes from the laws of nature. Just like Krishna says in the Divine and Dvaniyak chapters of Bhagavad Gita, life comes from sex, and there is no other cause. That's it. It's just material ingredients mixing with material ingredients. No other cause. Matter acting according to the laws of nature. There is nothing more. God is a myth. So, in very simple form, you know, kind of a non-bona fide shakta. But then he goes through the purport a little bit above those. Are persons who gradually rise to become Suryas, or worshippers of the sun god, and Ganapatyas, (worshippers of the mass of people, as Janatajanardana or Dharidra Narayana, etc., in the form of Ganapati. Now, there's no explanation why he calls the... Because this Dharidra Narayan is an impersonal idea, and they're not worshippers of Ganapati. So I don't know how what the connection is. Does anybody know the connection between Ganapati and those that are impersonalists? Other than some idea of you can worship the Pancha Upasana idea of the impersonalist, five different deities that one can worship, Ganapati being one of them. And it's a means to purify oneself so one can go beyond the form into the formless. That's the only thing I know, there's some connection. Worshipping the mass of the people in the form of Ganapati. Anyway, there's probably some kind of convoluted way that worshippers take that. And then, above is worship of Lord Shiva, in search of the ever-existing soul. And then, to the stage of worshipping Lord Vishnu, the super soul, etc. Without any information of Govinda, Lord Krishna was the original Lord Vishnu. In other ways, some are worshippers of race, nationality, birds, beasts, evil spirits, Satans, etc. Worship in the Lord of Ignorance. The general worship of Sannideva, the Lord of Distressful Condition. Ever heard of Sannideva before? Saturn.
Saturn.
Okay, the Lord of Distressful Condition.
South India, they have so many temples.
Where?
In South India.
South India, really?
Navagraha temples. Many.
Oh.
In Dallas or
in where?
Dallas.
In Dallas, there's a temple of this?
Navagraha.
Really?
I believe it.
So in astrology, it's, you know, once when Saturn is in this something or other house, it means
seven years of distress.
Okay, the Lord of Distressful Condition. So they worship him, like, so he'll keep off your case.
Reduce the
huh?
You worship to reduce the pain.
Really? Okay. And Sitala Devi, the goddess of smallpox.
Yes.
Yes? Really? They go to a Sitala Devi temple so their children don't get smallpox?
Yes. Chicken pox or smallpox, both of these kinds, the condition they worship
up. Phew.
They all know the different names in South India and North India, but
South also is the
same. Okay, so these are North Indian names. Is also common to the mass of people. And there are many foolish men who worship the mass of people or the poor class of men. Again, this is Janata Janardana and Dharidra Narayana. So different persons, societies and communities, etc., worship some of the potent manifestations of the Lord, wrongly accepting the powerful object as God. That's the problem. But in this verse is advised by Brahmaji that none of them is the Supreme Lord. They're only borrowed plumes from the original Almighty Lord Sri Krishna. When the Lord advises in Bhagavad Gita to worship him alone, it is to be understood that worshipping Lord Krishna includes worshipping all that is mentioned, because he, Lord Krishna, includes everyone. Okay, so that's the main point. The absolute truth is to be the object of worship, and by so doing, worship is complete. And that's a very important point when addressing people who in their upbringing were accustomed to this or that or the other kind of worship or multi-worship or so many things. Of course, it's hard because of sentiments to, like, redirect that to the absolute truth. Because the faith is weak and understanding is not clear. And even the whole idea of searching out the absolute truth is not really so clear. It's just kind of mindless. But there's some religious sentiment. The religious sentiment says, I should be respectful. I should offer some worship. Or because faith and worship are natural for the living entity, it comes out in some other way if the absolute truth is not understood. And being in the material world, we're here because we have some problem with Krishna. This is really standard stuff. I had very interesting experiences. This reminded me this past weekend, not this, but the weekend before, I was in New Jersey and one devotee was driving me, and the car that he was driving was where the gear is over here, but in his car the gear is up here to move from park to drive. So every time, like 6-7 times, got in the car, turned the engine on, keys in the same place. Because sometimes it's on the dashboard, sometimes it's on the column, but it was the same place. And then he would reach up here for moving from park to drive. Then catch himself and then move it from park to drive. But every time. We were just laughing about it. We're such creatures of habit. Without, you know, just mindlessly doing things. You know, the initial getting used to changing gears and driving a car, it's, difficult, but it's not difficult. It's just we're not used to it. But once you get used to it, it's just kind of mechanical. And worship tends to be like that too. One, you know, even moving from something to Krishna consciousness, one realizes, you know, what have I been doing? But then even in Krishna consciousness, it's just like, you know, we're not even thinking what we're doing. And that's not what we're supposed to be doing, is mindlessly doing things. And so repetition is there in the Bhagavatam and in the whole of Vedic literature to help us, you know, like, excuse me, but, you know, it's down here. Oh. Down here, excuse me. Oh. Just, and then we go, okay, it's down here, then it's habit again. We should not be mechanical in our activities. We should be mindful of, as we're worshiping Krishna. And if you speak these words with conviction and faith, not just, you know, scriptural authority, but if you have been doing so mindfully, then the words carry so much more weight. It just means, you know, you're more Krishna conscious. Purity is the force, another way of saying the same thing. So pure devotional service is where we're conscious of the object of our service. We're conscious of our relationship with Krishna. It's something like having a conversation with somebody where their hands and their body is preoccupied, but they're talking to you as if know, they're not giving full attention. They're just, and it goes on for 2 hours, like chanting, where we're calling Krishna's name, but our mind is all over the place. Something's, it's not very respectful. It's not right. So, to make that correction, we should be mindful, we should be present of, with Krishna, is not different than his name. Simple point. But be mindful of that simple point. Then the attention is a personal exchange with Krishna. When chanting, when worshipping, deity worship, hearing the scripture, this is the literary incarnation of Krishna we're associating with. So then, the next idea that he presents, last paragraph, is this, the form and formless idea. Generally, when Prabhupada put to as a question, when Prabhupada says, when we hear that the word, we hear the description in the Vedas that the Lord is formless, we are to understand, how does he complete the sentence? He has no material form. He has no material qualities, nirguna. He has no material form. Formless, he has no material form. So, here he's saying it, same message, but it's like reverse order, or a very different logical construct. When the Lord is described as formless in the Vedic literatures, it is to be understood that all these forms mentioned above, within the experience of universal knowledge, are different exhibitions of the Lord's transcendental potencies only, and none of them factually represents the transcendental form of the Lord. So he doesn't have a form like these. He has no material form. These are forms and forms and forms and forms and forms and forms, and he has no such form. In that sense, formless, not with material form. So, my dear devotees, when you're reading scriptures, that this happens sometimes, especially for, you know, people that are trained with college educations. You know, you want to see the symmetry and the consistency, and so you find words used this way over here and used differently over there. And match it, why does it work that way? Or just like this other example, Durga creates, maintains, and annihilates, but I thought that she's responsible for annihilation because that's what Lord Shiva and Brahma creates and Vishnu. So why is it, what's going on here? But we, devotees do this sometimes, that doubts arise due to, it says, you know, seemingly inconsistent things. We've all had that experience. And so although we're reading it here, okay, formless means, but we'll, you know, we'll go to a text and then it says formless. Oh, here's a scriptural reference that says the absolute is formless. And some doubt arises. Just so it's helpful when descriptions like this come, that you don't just put it in your information folder somewhere in the back. Just, you know, be aware that this is a principle. Because there are such references. Now, and there are such references in another sense, because there is a Brahman feature that's formless. Or there are statements that emphasize, including in the Bhagavatam, the oneness of the Supreme with all things. So, if someone has an impersonal philosophical, you know, background, they've been sufficiently polluted by that idea for some course of reading literatures previously, it kind of raises a doubt. This is, why is it saying this? I thought, it's just a word, Mike, I'm just making a comment about kind of the intellectual approach, the non-devotional intellectual approach to reading sometimes gets us into doubt problems. And one of the cures for that is just like step back and think of the big picture. Or one way is that a scriptural rule about scriptures is that there's a principle. Hi, Paul. There's a principle of in composition of scriptures, often towards the beginning, usually at the beginning, there's a mahavakya, or a principal utterance upon which all other statements of the scripture or that text are based, such that if there is some confusion somewhere along the line about what does this mean, you refer back to the Mahavakya. It's to be understood in that context. So that's another very simple check. And what that Mahavakya for the Bhagavatam is Vedanta tat tattva vedas tattvam yad jnanam advayam prameti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shavyate, and Krishna's tu bhagavan swayam. That verse from the third chapter, first canto. So the and Jiva Goswami presents like that in his Sandarbhas. So that's just a very simple way. If you find yourself in this doubt space, go to the Mahavakyas of the Bhagavatam, and just, it's like, you know, you have an object, you hold it up to the light, and then you can just very clearly see the, you know, what the object is in light of a very bright light source. Then you don't, if you hold it separately, it's not as clear. So this verse is saying that various manifestations, kind of like, you know, the opulences of the Absolute, they're to be understood as opulences of the Absolute, not the Absolute. Those that don't have an understanding of the Absolute look at the opulences and go, wow, must be God. Intelligent man is surprised to see the wonderful actions of material phenomena, as the aborigines are fearful of a great thunderbolt, a greater gigantic banyan tree, a great lofty mountain in the jungle. So in some places Prabhupada refers to that as just a natural tendency for worship. Even the aborigines, they'll worship something wonderful in nature, indicating it's natural. Here is, you know, it's misplaced. And so the last verse of the chapter, O Narada, I shall now state one after another the transcendental incarnations of the Lord known as Lila Avatars. Hearing of their activities counteracts all foul matter. Kashaya. Karna, Kashaya. Which Roshan, that which evaporates foul matter. Hearing of their activities counteracts all foul matters accumulated in the ear. These pastimes are pleasing to hear and are to be relished. Therefore, they are in my heart. So, that's nice. They're in his heart. When spiritual messages, the verse, I'm going to speak about a verse tomorrow evening that's from the second canto, chapter 8, where the verse is saying, when the transcendental messages enter into the ear, they then, spiritual messages then descend into the heart. And they act directly upon the heart. So here Brahma is saying, and they're still there. Because they're pure and they're purifying. They're resting. So he's going to speak from the heart about the pastimes of the Supreme Lord. In the purport, Prabhupada explains that there are two different categories of forms of the Lord who appear in this world. One is descriptions of basically the Purusha avatars. The one concerns the mundane manifestation of the material creative force, and the other deals with his pastimes in the form of different incarnations in terms of time and place. So, activities of the Lord within the world, as it was presented in chapter 3, we'll go back to chapter 1. In chapter 1 of the first canto, there are six questions asked by the sages, and one of those six questions is, can you please explain and describe the incarnations of the Lord as they appear in this world? And so, the answer to that question appears in chapter 3, and again it appears in canto 2, and of course the rest of the Bhagavatam expands it further. Incarnations of the Lord. Naturally, that's one of the entire messages of the whole Bhagavatam, the Lord as he appears in this world. It's not exhaustively all of them, because that's not possible, but principal forms of the Lord. But in that chapter 3, there's also a discussion about, or at least the presentation of, the Purusha avatars. Because those are also forms of the Lord in this world. They're not Leela avatars, but they're avatars, forms of the Lord in this world. And what their activities are is the creation of the universe. And so, just like there's discussion about Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan and Mathura and Dwaraka in the 10th canto, there's description in the 2nd canto here and elsewhere. 3rd canto, the just mention of it in the 1st canto, there's discussion about the Lord's creation. So when those discussions come up, very consistently, Prabhupada says that the foolish commentators, they go right to the 10th canto, but this is as spiritual as that is. But they look at it as in the wrong way. And it's very important to understand the sambandha gyan, the relationship between God's energies and him as the source of those energies, for very practical reasons. One practical reason is we're in the whole ocean of material energy. And if we don't see that material energy in relation to its source, while we may have some idea of, you know, Krishna in the spiritual world, it's, you know, we're disconnected from the material energy that's surrounding us, and we don't see its relation with Krishna. So, you know, it's, we're bewildered. And seeing in the proper manner takes away the bewilderment, or allows us to see how the Supreme Lord can be understood and appreciated through the material creation. It's like the question the other day, when we see something very wonderful in nature, is that okay? So it's more than okay, but the appreciation should go to the source. And that means also the, just as in this list, the ghosts and the, you know, the ghastly features of creation also. The devotional approach is very comprehensive. So though the going is a little tedious when it gets into, you know, the stages of the unfolding of creation and all those difficult things, but there's abundant information in the Bhagavatam about it, and there's a reason for it. So we can see the situation that we're in presently in relation to the Supreme Lord. So then we give our focus more to the Lord in the spiritual world. We're not, you know, this world is created by him or through his potencies. He's the cause of this, ultimately. So, next coming up is the list of, it's a smaller list than the found in the third canto. That's the next section I'm going to take up. Any questions or comments on this? Chapter 6, Canto 2. Thoughts. Prabhupada has given, remember a class that Rabindra Sarup Prabhu gave about when he was a philosophy PhD student, hearing Srila Prabhupada speaking, and one time he heard him say, when the devotee sees a tree, he doesn't see a tree, he sees Krishna. So he was a, you know, philosopher, philosophy of religion, thinking, you know, what does that mean? When you see a tree, you don't see a tree, you see Krishna. Does it literally mean you don't see the tree, you see Krishna, or does it mean do you see the tree in relation to Krishna, or do you see the super soul within? What does he see? The whole class just discussing that. And something that I remember Prabhupada saying is, when a father sees his child's shoes, he doesn't see the shoes, he sees his child. It's similar. When you see the shoes, you don't see the shoes, you see your child. What does that mean? It's not that he literally doesn't see the shoes. He sees his child, you know, in two pieces over there on the floor. It's the because of affection, because of attachment for the child. When he sees the shoes of the child, his thoughts go to the child. The feelings, the heart, goes to the child. Or the same thing, someone puts a picture of their family by their workplace. So they think of their family, although they're at the workplace. They're doing the work. When, back to your comment, wasn't exactly a question, but when you, as one progresses in spiritual life and one becomes a little more attached to Krishna, then your heart will be with Krishna in all circumstances. That is not sometimes because of that affinity or affection for Krishna, attachment for Krishna. Whatever's going on, whatever the senses are perceiving or whatever thoughts are going to, it's in relation to Krishna because of that attachment for Krishna. So that's how one can see Krishna everywhere. And that's what's in your heart. When you see the tree, you don't see the tree. You see Krishna. Let me just finish this. The other is as a kind of practice, whatever, just like in the opulence of the absolute chapter, whatever there is that's wonderful or splendorous in the world, one should think, just like this thing, you know, seeing a beautiful sunset or seeing something awesome in nature, one should think of who's behind it. And that way one can think of Krishna. Now, quite often in day-to-day life, passion prevails. The passion of there's a task, the task needs to be accomplished, I'm attached to accomplishing it, I'm attached to enjoying the fruit of accomplishing it, and all of my attention goes in passion to that. So when such a situation exists, any thought of Krishna is blocked, because it's just focused on, covered by the mode of passion. Attention is going there. So, one of the values of attentively hearing scripture is it reduces the passion and makes us more reflective of what's the message of Godhead. And so some of that stays with us, and so there's moments of appreciation, and then the rest is passion and ignorance. So the goodness portion of hearing from scripture is just to help us go into the transcendental level of hearing from scripture, where it actually transforms consciousness and touches the heart, and then an attachment for Krishna and rendering of service in that consciousness takes place, as opposed to I should do it, which is mode of goodness. And that is, so this relates to the japa discussion we had. You know, sometimes there's attentiveness and sometimes it's something else, and when it's something else, there's no taste and so on. We're so accustomed to not being in goodness that, you know, being in goodness is hard to stay there. It's rare to get there and it's hard to stay there. And it's not... Passion covers perception of Krishna, not enhances. So, orienting our lives, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur was saying it very, very nicely, but organizing our lives in such a way that mode of goodness is the frame in which we're functioning as far as possible, and then focus on our primary activities, primary devotional activity, hearing, chanting, remembering, worshipping, praying. So, question? I have a question.
My question was that if one understands and one starts looking at material and articulation with Krishna, could there be a state where one feels well, then maybe there is appropriate and enjoying material energy as well, but not enjoying in a degraded fashion, but let's say people who are situated in the mode of goodness and who are conditioned to happiness, they might be there.
That's exactly how they feel. There's one cure. I only know of one cure. And that's deferring the position of enjoyment to he who is the enjoyer. And accepting the position of servant of us who are that's our constitutional position. Our enjoyment is in serving, not our enjoyment is in enjoying the prakriti. Taking the position of imitation purusha denies that spiritual happiness of service. But it's an interesting point to bring up, because one approaches that position of transcendence through goodness. So that's an enticement. Again, borrowing from the Bhaktivinoda Thakur reference from yesterday, it's the prejudice of goodness, where one feels, as Baladeva Vidyabhusan says, I'm happy. I'm quite contented. I have knowledge. And in this way, one becomes conditioned by the mode of goodness. So, we're not so much in that state. We're much more in the state of passion. And it's good, and with passion it burns. So, you know, we don't like the burning, and so we want release from that because we want happiness. So beware. From this position, if the service of Krishna position is accepted, that can protect us from this point that you were just making. It's okay. I'm okay. It's okay. I'm situated in knowledge. I'm feeling illuminated. You say that this world is filled with suffering. I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe others are suffering, but so it can steal away the access to transcendence. So the protection is having a very clear conception of what our constitutional position is. That's our constitutional happiness. And that constitutional happiness cannot be compared to mode of goodness happiness. For one who has tasted even a drop of it. But for those who have not, they can't fathom anything but. Then that's very strong. You know, the sense of being a good person is altruism, philanthropy, the Mother Teresa role model. When no doubt, the sentiment of Mother Teresa or such persons is a feeling of contentedness, an enormous amount of self-sacrifice. Feeling, close to God, feeling some sense of godliness. But no doubt from the practical choices that she took up, there's something missing. Feeding people, there's something missing. What if goodness isn't transcendence? But it can be very powerful, compelling. And some persons, one of the individuals that I've met with in the course of this visit, is struggling with that. Their strong attraction, because when they're feeling spiritual, that the urge is to do humanitarian work. But then they hear this thing about not humanitarian work, so they feel uncomfortable. Anything else? Yes.
So, this is kind of like a bridge question. Today you were mentioning this person who was going up for the gear level.
Yeah.
Upper. So it's kind of very hard to break your habits, sort of thing.
We're creatures of habit.
Right. And then in your Bhakti Aloka seminars, they were like, we should control our anger.
Yeah.
Sometimes the anger comes in like milliseconds. Like it's like we don't get a chance to reflect upon the fact that we shouldn't be angry. It's just happens. So does that sort of decrease because of other practices that we do have the control?
Yes. Yes. Two things. Again, taking this picture of framing your life in the quality of goodness and saying, over here there's this, we discussed it, but over here there's something that keeps me from goodness, or it's totally apart from goodness. So one of the ways to address it is to borrow strength from that which you don't have a problem with, and that the more that you're in that mode, and fixed by transcendental activities, then, you know, that the reflective propensity comes. You know, it opens up. And it's a spiritual and combined preponderance of goodness consequence. Second thing is, Prabhupada used a phrase repeatedly that I didn't understand for a very long time and finally started to understand it. But by practice, by cultivation, something can become our second nature. So we can replace, if say my tendency is when somebody does the da da da, I get angry. And so that, and that's, you know, my tendency. That's conditioned tendency. That's my nature, svabhava. But one can create second nature by saying, by repeated impressions. You know, how many times, at some point, whether it's 5 times or 10 times or 100 times, eventually I'm going to not just reach, I'm going to, you know, when I sit down, I'm going to think, okay, before I even reach for the key, ignition, the park to drive is down here. So by cultivation, that which in the past was, you know, an anger trigger for me, even before I sit down, I'm going to think, okay, chance, there's a chance, a good chance, that something is going to trigger, and I, you know, I'm not going to go there, because, you know, I process this very carefully and enough mode of goodness and enough transcendental life that I'm ready for that. When it starts to go like this, I'm just going to go like this. In a sense, spiritual strength and, you know, super soul is going to prompt me instead of the modes of nature. And the modes of nature may do their prompt, but, you know, Krishna is going to give you the intent. And it happens like that. It's just the Krishna connection by practice can overcome anything. That's a conditioned tendency, however strong it may be. Like fear of death, or however strong it may be. So there's the combination of practice and transcendence. And then it becomes second nature. Then it becomes transcendental life. Anything else?
Yeah. No, in previous point you discussed, when you come across people who are more inclined towards humanitarian efforts and helping people, so how do we deal with them? What do we do? Those are the people who looks like more difficult to handle with than people who are in distress.
Well, I spent a fair amount of time with this one individual, helping them understand the different, well, I used the example of the bird in the cage, and used the example of the coat of the drowning man. And, you know, the real need is to understand the soul, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1 and the first part of 2, it's right on the same point where there's undeniable virtue, and wanting to help other people certainly is undeniably its virtue, but then virtue needs to be applied with a transcendental conception. that was what Krishna said. So he went through the soul and the coverings of the soul. So let's go back, let's revisit, you know, helping other people. It must be applied with the proper conception. And I spent some time, you know, there's a conventional definition of ahimsa and there's a transcendental conception of ahimsa. It's right in the Bhagavad Gita. I gave the example of I'm a doctor. I'm off duty. I'm walking down the street with my medical bag. They see somebody hemorrhaging on the sidewalk. They think, I don't want to malpractice it. I'm going to keep going. Just walk right by. Because I'm not on call. I'm just, you know, a civilian right now. So that's violence. Violence is when you have the capacity to relieve another's suffering and you do nothing. So the soul that's caught in the cycle of birth and death, so you can ease their pain, give them something to eat, take care of a medical problem, but you could have done more, and then you walk on. So it's your duty in the human form of life to have the realization of the soul and the soul's release from permanent suffering. Permanent solution. You have that capacity. You don't use it, that's violence. Now, worldly people don't think that way. Transcendentalists think that way. That's the message that Krishna is sharing with us. You're violence to yourself. And because it's violence to yourself, it's violence to others. You have the capacity to end the cycle of birth and death and you don't do it. You have the capacity, potential, to be an instrument of Krishna to relieve another person from birth and death and you don't do it. That's why so much emphasis on the direct devotional practices to awaken that consciousness so that then when you go into the field of life and you're rescuing the jacket, you rescue the person too. Go ahead, rescue the jacket. But don't neglect the person. And we have such examples of institutionalized, you know, giving the example that Hargala says this vision to do that right here in Seattle. Get on board. But don't get on board as a jacket saver and a cage polisher. Get on board as the person that understands what is the soul. And while doing this, we're going to do that too. You don't feed the bird, leave the cage dirty. Polish the cage and let the bird die. That takes some spiritual training. And it's not available in the marketplace. Go find it. It's not there. And since so it's such a disproportionate absence of that spiritual training, there's strong emphasis. You get out all the other, you know, how to do things out there, but not with a spiritual conception. Okay. See the Prabhupada? Yes.
Thank you.